We could go up to the restaurant, Reacher said. Bureau could buy me lunch.
I just bought you lunch, Harper said.
No, that was a late breakfast.
You're always eating, she said.
I'm a big guy, he said. I need nutrition.
They checked their coats in the lobby and rode up to the top of the building, waited in line at the restaurant desk, with Harper pressed up against the wall of windows, gazing out at the view. She showed her badge and they got a table for two, right at a window facing directly back up West Broadway and Fifth Avenue beyond, from a quarter mile high.
Awesome, she said.
It was awesome. The air was crisp and clear, and the view extended 100 miles. The city was cocky, far below them in the fall light, packed, intricate, infinitely busy. The rivers were green and gray. The outer boroughs faded into Westchester and Connecticut and Long Island. The other direction, New Jersey, crowded the bank and curved away in the far distance.
Bob's over there, she said.
Someplace, Reacher agreed.
Who is Bob?
He's an asshole. She smiled.
Not a very exact description, criminologically speaking.
He's a storeman, Reacher said. A 9-to-5 guy, if he's in the bar every night.
He's not our guy, right?
He's nobody's guy, Reacher thought. He's small time, he said. Selling out of the trunk of his car in the parking lot? No ambition. Not enough at stake to make it worth killing people.
So, how can he help us?
He can name names. He's got suppliers and he knows who the other players are. One of the other players will name more names, and then another, and another.
They all know each other?
Reacher nodded. They carve it up. They have specialties and territories, same as anybody else.
Could take us a long time.
I like the geography here, Reacher said.
The geography? Why?
It makes sense. You're in the army, you want to steal weapons. Where do you steal them from? You don't creep around the barracks at night and pull them out from every footlocker you see. That way you get yourself about 8 hours grace until the guys wake up and say, "Hey, where's my damn Beretta?"
So, where do you steal them from?
Someplace they won't be missed, which means storage. Find a stockpile facility where they're laid up ready for the next war.
And where are those?
Look at an interstate map.
Why interstate?
Why do you think the interstates were built? Not so the Harper family could drive from Aspen to Yellowstone Park on vacation. So the army could move troops and weapons around fast and easy.
They were?
Reacher nodded.
Sure they were. Eisenhower built them in the '50s, height of the Cold War thing, and Eisenhower was a West Pointer, first and last.
So?
So you look where the interstates all meet. That's where they put the storage, so the stuff can go any which way, moment's notice, mostly just behind the coasts, because old Ike wasn't too worried about parachutists dropping into Kansas. He was thinking of ships coming in from the sea.
And Jersey is good for that?
Reacher nodded again.
Great strategic location. Therefore, lots of storage. Therefore, lots of theft.
Therefore, Bob might know something.
He'll point us in a new direction. That's about all we can count on from Bob.
His lunch break is no good. No good at all. You keep the field glasses tight to your eyes and watch the whole thing happen. A second black-and-white prowl car noses around the corner and moves slowly up the hill. It stops flank to flank against the first one and stays there, motor running. Two of the damn things, side by side. Probably the whole of the police department's fleet, right there in front of you. You get a partial view. The driver's window is down on both cars. There's a brown paper sack and a closed cup of coffee. The new guy lifts them across the gap, elbow high, to keep them upright. You adjust the focus on the field glasses. You see the waiting cop reach out. The scene is flat and two-dimensional and grainy, like the optics are at their limit. The cop takes the coffee first. His head turns as he finds the cup holder inside. Then he takes the bag. He props it on the ledge of his door and unrolls the top. Glances down. Smiles. He has a big, meaty face. He's looking at a cheeseburger or something. Maybe two of them. And a wedge of pie. He rolls the top of the sack again and swings it inside. Almost certainly dumps it on his passenger seat. Then his head is moving. They're chatting. The cop is animated. He's a young guy. The flesh of his face is tight with youth. He's full of himself, enchanted with his important mission. You watch him for a long moment. Watch the happy expression on his face. Wonder what that face will look like when he walks to her door for a bathroom break and gets no reply to his knock. Because right there and then you decide two things. You're going in there to do the job. And you're going to work it without killing the cop first, just because you want to see that expression change. The Nissan Maxima was briefly a drug dealer's favorite ride, so Reacher felt okay about using it to get out to the Jersey bar. It would look innocent enough parked in the lot. It would look real. Unmarked government cars never did. A normal person spends 20 grand on a sedan. He goes ahead and orders the chrome wheels and the pearl coat along with it. The government never did, so their cars looked obvious, artificially plain, like they had big signs painted on the side saying, "This is a police unmarked." And if Bob saw such a thing in the lot, he'd break the habit of a lifetime and spend his evening someplace else. Reacher drove. Harper preferred not to, not in the dark and the rush hour. And rush hour was bad. Traffic was slow up the spine of Manhattan and jammed at the entrance to the tunnel. Reacher played with the radio and found a station where a woman was telling him how long he was going to have to wait. 40-45 minutes. That was about twice as slow as walking, which was exactly how it felt. They inched forward, deep under the Hudson River. His backyard was 60 miles upstream. He sat there and traced its contours in his mind, testing his decision. It was a nice enough yard, as yards go. Certainly it was fertile. You turned your head, the grass was a foot high when you turned it back. It had a lot of trees, maples which had been cute in the early fall, cedars which Leon must have planted himself because they were placed in artful groups. Leaves came off the maples and little purple berries came off the cedars. When the leaves were down, there was a wide view of the opposite bank of the river. West Point was right there, and West Point had been an important part of Reacher's life. But he was not a nostalgic guy. Part of being a drifter means you look forward, not backward. You concentrate on what's ahead. And he felt in his gut that a big part of looking ahead was looking for newness. Looking for places you hadn't been and things you hadn't seen. And the irony of his life was that although he had covered most of the Earth's surface one time or another, he felt he hadn't seen much. A lifetime in the service was like rushing down a narrow corridor, eyes fixed firmly to the front. There was all kinds of enticing stuff off to the sides, which you rushed past and ignored. Now he wanted to take the side trips. He wanted a crazy zigzag, any direction he felt like, any old time he chose. And returning to the same place every night wouldn't do it. So his decision was the right one. He said the words to himself. Sell the house. The house is on the market. The house is for sale. The house is sold. He said the words and a weight came up off him. It wasn't just the practical weight, although that was important. No more fretting about leaks in the pipes and bills in the mail and oil deliveries and insurance coverage. It was the release, like he was back in the world, unburdened. He was free and ready to go. It was like a door opening and sunlight flooding in. He smiled to himself in the thrumming darkness of the tunnel, Harper at his side.
"You actually enjoying this?" she said.
"Best mile of my life," he answered.
You wait and you watch, hour after hour. Perfectionism like that you don't find everywhere. But you are perfect, and you have to stay perfect. You have to stay sure. And by now you're sure the cop is a permanent fixture. He eats in his car. He uses her bathroom from time to time, and that's it. So you think about hijacking the cop, maybe tomorrow morning, just before 8 o'clock, and impersonating him, replacing him on duty. You think about sitting in his car for a spell, and then walking up to Skimica's door and knocking, like you were ready to relieve yourself. You think about that for around a second and a half, and then you're rejected, of course. His uniform wouldn't fit, and you'd be expected to chat with the bureau guy at the 8 o'clock handover. He'd know you were a fake straight off the bat. It's not like he's dealing with a big, anonymous police department like he'd get in New York or L.A. So either the cop has to be moved, or you have to go in right past him. At first you toy with the idea of a diversion. What would it take to get him out of there? A major automobile accident at the crossroads, maybe? A fire in the school, perhaps? But as far as you know, the village doesn't have a school. You've seen yellow buses on the road heading in and out toward Portland. The school is probably in another jurisdiction. And an automobile accident would be hard to stage. Certainly you're not about to involve yourself in one. And how do you induce two other drivers to get in a smash? Maybe a bomb threat, but where? At the station house? That would be no good. The cop would be told to stay where he was, safely out of the way until it was checked out. So where else? Some spot where people are gathered, maybe. Somewhere the whole police department would be needed to handle the evacuation. But this is a tiny place. Where do people gather? The church, maybe. You can see a spire down near the through road, but you can't wait until next Sunday. The library? Probably nobody in there. Two old dears at most, sitting there doing their needlepoint, ignoring the books. Evacuation could be handled by the other cop on his own in about 3.5 seconds. And a bomb threat would mean a phone call. You start to think about that. Where from? Calls can be traced. You could head back to the airport in Portland and call from there. Tracing a call to an airport payphone is the same thing as not tracing it at all. But then you're miles out of position at the critical time. A safe call, but a useless call. Catch 22. And there are no payphones within a million miles of where you're crouched, not in the middle of the damn Rocky Mountains, or whatever the hell they call them. And you can't use your mobile, because eventually the call would appear on your bill, which ultimately is the same thing as a confession in open court. And who can you call? You can't allow anybody to hear your voice. It's too distinctive, too dangerous. But the more you think about it, the more your strategy centers around the phone. There's one person you can safely let hear your voice, but it's a geometric problem. Four-dimensional, time and space. Have to call from right here, in the open, within sight of the house. But you can't use your mobile. Impasse. They drove out of the tunnel and streamed west with the traffic. Route 3 angled slightly north toward the turnpike. It was a shiny night in New Jersey, damp asphalt everywhere, sodium lights with evening fog halos strung like necklaces. There were lit billboards and neon signs left and right, establishments of every nature behind lumpy blacktop yards. The roadhouse they were looking for was in the back of a leftover lot where three roads met. It was labeled with a beer company's neon sign which said McSteofans, which, as far as Reacher understood Gaelic, meant Stevenson's. It was a low building with a flat roof. Its walls were faced with brown boards, and there was a green neon shamrock in every window. Its parking lot was badly lit and three-quarters empty. Reacher put the Maxima at a casual angle across two spaces near the door, slid out, and looked around. The air was cold. He turned a full circle in the dark, scanning the lot against the lights from the street. "No Cadillac DeVille," he said. "He's not here yet." Harper looked at the door cautiously.
"We're a little early," she said. "I guess we'll wait."
"You can wait out here," he said, "if you prefer." She shook her head.
"I've been in worse places," she said.
It was hard for Reacher to imagine where and when. The outer door led to a 6x6 lobby with a cigarette machine and a sisal mat worn smooth and greasy with use. The inner door led to a low dark space full of the stink of beer fumes and smoke. There was no ventilation running.
The green shamrocks in the windows shone inward as well as outward and gave the place a pale, ghostly glare. The walls were dark boards, dulled and sticky with 50 years of cigarettes. The bar was a long wooden structure with half barrels stuck to the front. There were tall bar stools with red vinyl seats and lower versions of the same thing scattered around the room near tables built of lacquered barrels with plywood circles nailed to their tops. The plywood was rubbed smooth and dirty from thousands of wrists and hands. There was a bartender behind the bar and 8 customers in the body of the room. All of them had glasses of beer set on the plywood in front of them. All of them were men. All of them were staring at the newcomers. None of them was a soldier. They were all wrong for the military. Some were too old, some were too soft, some had long dirty hair, just ordinary working men, or maybe unemployed. But they were all hostile. They were silent, like they had just stopped talking in the middle of low, muttered sentences. They were staring, like they were trying to intimidate.